Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the pandemic is raising the risk of death for people with dementia or diabetes, even if they never become ill with the virus. We'll hear from Lisa Walk, chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And the Philadelphia Orchestra's principal guest conductor, Natalie Stutzman, will join us. We'll talk about what she's preparing for the 2021-22 season and about the strides women have made as conductors on the international stage. But to begin, it's been well over a half year since civil trials in Philadelphia were waylaid by the pandemic. But a logjam of cases created by the suspension of court proceedings could soon start to ease. The first judicial district has announced plans to resume civil jury trials on January 21st. The trials will be held in person, and many details are still being worked out. The decision is being greeted by attorneys with a mix of relief and caution, and there are questions about the timing of the resumption. Efforts to restart criminal trial proceedings were suspended just a couple months ago, and even with vaccination close at hand, experts have said the effects of the pandemic could be with us through much of 2021. Max Mitchell is chief political reporter for the Legal Intelligencer and Law.com, and he joins us now for some analysis. Hi, Max.
Hi, Mary.
So in person civil trials will resume in Philadelphia in just a few weeks. Let's focus first on what we do know about how these proceedings might be held in light of health and safety concerns about the pandemic. First, jury selection should take place in the room in which it normally does in Philly, Max?
Yeah, that's my understanding. It's one of the largest rooms, and so it's the most conducive to gatherings, you know, during the pandemic when social distancing is so important.
And the first judicial district is expected to publish safety protocol for the overall operation of court business, that, you know, in-person jury selection, trials, et cetera. Any word as to when that protocol will be made public?
I do not know exactly when that's going to be made public, but it does. My understanding is that everything is still in the works. Unfortunately, I don't have a date really for when we'll be expecting that.
We'll be watching for it. Yeah, that's fine. Is the January 21st start date set in stone? Have you heard anything about that?
No, it doesn't. I mean, according to the court, it is, you know, this is what everybody's planning for. But attorneys on the ground are a little bit more skeptical. I guess cautiously optimistic might be the better way to say it. But yeah, there's a fair amount of waiting with bated breath and just to see if this actually is when it gets off the ground. I think a lot of attorneys are very excited for the idea of just having their trials scheduled. It sounds like that alone is going to put a lot of pressure on defense counsel and the parties involved to really sort of get settlements underway. A lot like, you know, criminal cases, which most end up in plea deals, and on the civil side, the vast majority end up settling. And so just having that trial date puts a lot of pressure and gets a lot of the sort of settlement discussions in the works. And so far, a lot of sort of what's led to having such a growth in the inventory, you know, such a backlog, is the fact that there isn't any trial date that's out there. And so this pressure is just non-existent. So just having that alone, I think, is leading to a lot of optimism and a lot of positivity, I guess, in the plaintiff's
sure.
bar. But still sort of pretty cautiously optimistic, just given the challenges that are out there.
So it's fascinating. Without the pressure of a trial, many of these cases were not going to settlement. They would have normally done so with
right.
a trial in front of them. Okay.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And
that's a big...
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Oh, I was just going to say that's a very important, you know, the most important part of the case, really. And it's sort of the focal point. Everything sort of comes together right then. And that's why you see so many settlements sort of on the courthouse steps, as they say.
What types of civil cases are we talking about here?
So the smaller civil cases, my understanding is that those have been able to move somewhat, but the larger, the more sort of catastrophic cases and like medical malpractice cases, those are Those are the ones that have seen the slowest movement and had very little settlement, if any, whatsoever, from my understanding. So it sounds like in those areas in particular, attorneys are very, you know, happy or at least, you know, hopeful that getting trial dates out there will help kind of keep those moving. But from my understanding, that sort of fits the major jury section. Those are the bigger cases, and those are some of the cases that are on for trial. Those are the ones that I understand that they're really sort of trying to call juries in for on that January 21st date.
Okay, and so we're talking about cases in which millions are at stake.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it sounds like the smaller sort of, you know, fender bender type cases, that those are the ones that are still have been able to move somewhat and haven't seen quite the total sort of backlog.
And Max Mitchell, unique to the pandemic, a number of plaintiff attorneys have apparently told you they're being told their cases need to take a COVID discount. What's that?
Yeah, it kind of depends on who you talk to, sort of, and how they portray it. But the plaintiff's bar basically has reported to me that a lot of defense attorneys will tell them, yeah, that because it's going to be so long until we can even get a trial date, and there's so many new additional sort of complications that have arisen out of the COVID, you know, 19 pandemic, that it could even add to the appellate issues later on. So the idea is that the defense bar puts them in a bit of a stronger position because this could end up taking so much longer than usual. And a lot of plaintiffs' firms, you know, there's some economics to it. The firm, you know, depends on settlements coming in. Their clients, you know, and oftentimes are out of work, injured. So there's some pressure there that the defense bar, this is sort of from the plaintiff's perspective, is that, you know, the defense bar is using that pressure to, you know, to say you need to take a quote unquote sort of COVID discount, which I've heard is like between 10 and 15% of what the attorney would value the case at and, you know, would think that they would normally get outside of the pandemic. Now, the defense counsel, if you talk to them, they're sort of a different mindset, and it's really that they feel that the pandemic and sort of the pause on the on trials has really made it so you can no longer sort of rely on the threat of sort of, let's see what a jury does. You have to rely more on the facts of the case, and so they say that there's no sort of COVID discount really. It's just sort of making the plaintiff's bar a little more dependent on the facts of you know, each particular case.
So the shape of the
depends on who you ask.
Yeah, the shape of the dance has changed in the pandemic.
Exactly. Yes.
We have a question from Leonard who asks, does the backlog of civil cases have any effect on the scheduling of criminal cases? What have you heard, if anything, Max?
I don't believe so. They are very separate tracks. Criminal cases take place at the Criminal Justice Center, and the civil cases, they are tried in City Hall. So they're even different buildings. They're different. They're very different tracks. The state sort of tracks the is much more involved in the criminal. That's sort of a unified statewide sort of processing, case management. And then the civil are really very individualized to the counties. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that they're going to be very separate, and that's not going to affect criminal as much.
All right. Thanks for that question, Leonard. So let's get back to how civil trials might be conducted. I know we're still waiting for the safety protocol from the First Judicial District as to how we're going to keep, you know, jurors being selected and actual trial proceedings as safe as possible during the pandemic. I understand that the convention center is being considered as a spot to hold civil trials. If so, what is the thinking here? Is it something to do with the size?
Yeah. So my understanding is that a lot of they're sort of looking to other counties to see how other counties have done it. Because Philadelphia has, you know, unique issues to Philadelphia. And my understanding is that sort of even things like the architecture of a building really affect how, you know, the airflow and how people can move about in a building. And City Hall, you know, there's often have to take an elevator, you know, or be in sort of small staircases. So movability is very difficult. I think the convention center, since it's mostly on the first floor, that's where that advantage would be. There's also, you know, in City Hall, there are windows. I know in the Criminal Justice Center, there are mostly no windows as far as, as far as I know, for most of the rooms where the trials would take place. And that's very disconcerting to a lot of attorneys who just aren't comfortable and don't, you know, have a lot of information about the airflow and the air filtration systems. Sure. And things like that. Yeah. So that's one of the ideas that's sort of been out there as the convention center. I know other counties have even, I've heard of some civil proceedings, and I believe it was a jury selection taking place in a casino. So anywhere that's a big space, I think courts across the state have been sort of looking towards.
That just paints an interesting picture, Max. But so.
Right, right.
So it just feels as if there are all these details still hanging out there. And yet we have a date of January 21st as at least the presumed start date for civil trials in Philadelphia. A lot to get our arms around.
Yeah. That's right. And I mean, there's a lot as well that is outside of the courts. The court's hands. In particular, Philadelphia has to deal with, you know, large populations that are reliant on public transportation.
Yeah.
And so that's a very big factor. And I think that's really where a lot of the caution from the attorney show up is less about whether or not the court can make it safe, but whether or not people are going to actually have faith that it's going to be safe and actually show up.
Well, I know that you report in Lackawanna County, you know, which is in northeast Pennsylvania, jury participation rate has fallen from 35% to 15%. I mean, courts are already holding in-person trials there. We don't have much time left in this segment, only about 30 seconds or so. But,
sure.
Boy, that presents a big, perhaps an even bigger challenge in Philadelphia for the reasons you just mentioned, and also because COVID is impacting communities of color disproportionately.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And there are some ways to sort of discuss how to, on the civil side, limit the amount of jurors that you would need in a case, which can help kind of alleviate the number of jurors you need to call. But yeah, it's still a lot of issues that are out there and need to be sort of really thoroughly looked at.
All right. Well, the story continues. Stay tuned. We'll probably be talking to you again in the future. Max Mitchell, Chief Political Reporter for the Legal Intelligencer. Thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Up next, Lisa Walk, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, on the higher risk for some during the pandemic. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Some casualties of the coronavirus pandemic are obvious. Those who die from the disease, of course. Survivors who suffer debilitating symptoms for months on end, and exhausted healthcare professionals. Still, there are others who might never be infected by COVID, but whose illnesses and higher risk for death are exacerbated by the mere presence of coronavirus in their communities. According to a recent Philadelphia Inquirer analysis, people with Alzheimer's disease or diabetes died at a higher than expected rate from March to November of last year. In New Jersey, the number of deaths for people with diabetes was up 33%. So what's the connection to the pandemic, and what needs to happen to make certain the risk for death in vulnerable populations is kept to a minimum? Lisa Walk is chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and also associate professor of medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. And she's with us now on the Roundup. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And before we get going, lines are open at 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. So there's a lot to unpack here. According to federal data, the number of deaths from Alzheimer's and diabetes was 14% higher than expected in Pennsylvania during that time period last year. And in New Jersey, 11% for Alzheimer's. And again, 33% for diabetes. Really concerning numbers, Lisa Walk. Were you expecting this?
Well, to say the expecting it, is it unexpected? No. Are there reasons that we can explain it? What to expect? I think, as we all know, last year was a hard year to plan.
Yeah.
What to expect, what was going to happen, particularly because we are focusing so much on just COVID itself and individuals and how the impact of the illness, and we're just starting to understand some of the impacts of COVID on those who either didn't get the illness themselves or did have the illness and recovered. We're still going to have several more months before we truly have the complete impact of this virus, but there are plausible explanations for why we're seeing the data we're seeing.
Well, let's focus on Alzheimer's first and tackle one of the most talked about ramifications of the pandemic, and that is the isolation that many seniors have been experiencing. How does isolation harm older people in particular, and for those with dementia?
So for older people in general, regardless of their cognitive status, being connectedness, being part of community, friends, family, that's very important for all of us at all stages, but particularly as we get older. You want to recognize and feel that people are looking for you. You have something to look forward to. You're engaging. You're cognitively stimulating yourself just by conversations, doing activities, doing crafts, things like that. And so to have a time where, for a public health reason, and appropriately so, wanting to protect our older adults and having them more isolated, the unintended consequence of that was less cognitive stimulation, less opportunity to be with family and friends, and trying to have that balance of keeping our older adults safe so they were less likely to contract COVID-19, but then also by the same token, then they were not engaging as much. And as you all know, everything closed down, right? So senior centers, community centers, religious organizations, all these things that you don't necessarily even think of as being opportunities to interact and engage with others. They were just, quote unquote, part of our lives. Even going to the store, that, you know, is an activity for some, and that was cut out as well for many individuals. So particularly, that's while it had an impact on all older adults, particularly for individuals with dementia, routine is very important. So having a routine, having a practice, a day-to-day schedule is helpful. Obviously, having interactions with others then becomes even more helpful, not just to help you with your day-to-day, but again, that cognitive stimulation, that emotional connection. So we've seen that both in older adults who were in assisted living facilities, but even those in the community really have suffered during this period of time in COVID because of the social isolation.
What are the answers? Simple question, but I'm sure a tough and complicated response.
So we have to be creative and think of the best ways that we can to kind of balance having more interaction and keeping our older adults safe. So, for example, I know that some of my patients who reside in assisted living facilities, they started doing chair exercises with individuals in their doorways, right? So instead of it being a class that they would normally have in the large room, everyone had their chair in their own doorway, so they were distanced, as we recommend, but they were still able to participate in an exercise class and still have that sense of you not just being completely isolated by yourself, but there are others, you can see them in their doorways also participating. Something like that. That's a creative idea of how to, one, get the physical activity, but then also the connected. For individuals who are living in the community, either with a spouse or alone or with children, if children are coming to visit, or grandchildren in particular, and are being socially distant, as recommending, I've recommended to my patients that the grandchildren leave something behind, a card or a craft or something that they made. it's a way to visually show the older adult, particularly if they have any cognitive issues later on, that someone was here, right? It's a visual prompt, a reminder that, yes, my grandchild was here. They did come to visit. So things like that we can do. Obviously, telephone is another option. Video visits, as we've all become more than familiar with, is another option as well. But even without those things, you can do more simple things just to let people know that they haven't been forgotten.
Yeah, do as much as you can to keep that social contact alive. I don't know about you, Lisa Walk, but one of the things I'm missing most during this pandemic is the ability to hug my family members. It's such a simple gesture, and I'm mm-hmm. guessing especially important for those of us who are older. What does just the physical gesture of a hug do for us and benefit us? How does it benefit us physically and emotionally? And are there any substitutes? Will there be, until this pandemic is resolved?
Well, so we know touch is really important, right? Even from infancy, children that are not held, children that are not that don't have that physical contact, they don't do as well as those who do, right? We've learned that from our pediatric colleagues a while back. So we know touch is important for us as individuals our entire lives, beginning from infancy. So you're right, that is a big thing that's been lost by many, is just being able that simple kind of hug, a greeting, a handshake. You know, even now we're kind of doing elbow or bumps types of things to even have that physical contact. So will we get that back? Yes, we definitely will. Right now, it still remains safer to not have as much physical touch contact in that regard for individuals outside of your household. But certainly if you're living in the same household with other individuals and you're all in the same space, and in other words, you're in the same quote-unquote bubble, then certainly there's no reason why you couldn't hug that individual or show that kind of physical contact in that regard.
Yeah, this is a broad question, but do you know if nursing home protocol has developed to better address this sort of issue with physical touch and with isolation as the pandemic continues?
Well, definitely nursing homes have been challenged and have been really creative in a lot of different ways. And in terms of the physical touch aspect, obviously individuals who need help with their day-to-day activities have that kind of home health aide, you know, someone who's there touching in a kind of helping you with your day-to-day. But in this environment where we are now, of having a lot of nursing assistants, people in the nursing homes have been going above and beyond. They've been doing that simple hand holding or a rub on the back or things like that to give the physical contact. Not that they didn't do it before, but everyone's just more mindful of that now, because you know that might be the only physical contact they get. Obviously, being inside the same, you know, the same bubble, so to speak, in the same environment, it's safer for the healthcare workers to be able to do that. So that's been true in nursing homes. We've been doing in the hospital, just much more mindful of being able to have that human contact for individuals.
The light at the end of the tunnel, of course, is vaccination. You know, many folks have expressed reservations about taking the vaccine, you know, whichever one it is at hand, preferring to wait and see. What are the risks of vaccines approved so far that might be unique to older people, if there are any?
We don't know of any that are unique to older adults at this point in time. What we know for the vaccines is, like much of any vaccine, the flu vaccine, other vaccines that we get, you can get side effects, meaning some soreness at the site of the injection. Perhaps a little bit of a low-grade temp. That's your body fighting. That's your body building up the immunity and doing what we want it to do, building up the antibodies, getting the T cells and the B cells activated. So that's not unexpected. We see that with other vaccines. We expect that for this vaccine as well, both of them, the Pfizer and the Moderna. What we are looking for now, it's more of adverse effects, so effects that we're not expecting, and that has been in the news as well, of individuals who have a history of allergies in the past having more of a hyper reactive response to the vaccine. But beyond that, we haven't seen any major adverse effects, and certainly none that are particular to older adults.
That's encouraging. And of course, vaccines are now being distributed to residents of care facilities.
Yes.
Guessing there will still be, however, a need for distancing and even some isolation, even as these folks are vaccinated for the time being.
Yes. Well, so we know that both of the vaccines that are currently approved in the U.S. are both two-dose vaccinations, right? And so that after the first dose, you do get some immunity, but it's around 50%, the studies have shown. It's the second dose, having that two dose, that gets you to the 94-95% effectiveness and immunity. So until we have people with both doses, where we know we have the highest chance of individuals being immune, but in addition, we really need to have about 70-80% of the population vaccinated to develop what we call herd immunity, meaning that you have enough people who are no longer susceptible to the virus in order for the virus not to remain active and contactable within the community. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason why there's been so much of a push in educating and letting people know and trying to see if we can get up to that 70-80%. And this is true for any vaccine, not just this one. We know that when we've seen numbers in the past, whether it's measles or polio, smallpox, when you see that real drop where it becomes less of an issue in the community is when the majority of that population, again, at least 70%, is vaccinated. And so even though we're starting to do some community vaccinations now, we started with the nursing homes, people still need to get that second dose, and then we still need to have the population overall, hopefully a good majority vaccinated. So more than likely, and given that the rollout's taking a little bit longer than predicted initially, it'll probably be another couple of months at least until we start pulling back with all of the social isolation and getting back to a little bit of a normal lifestyle. But the good thing is, as I say myself and say to others, it's fewer months than we've already put into it, more than likely. Right? So it shouldn't be another 9 months. Like, hopefully it'll be about 6 or 7.
Well, we're all looking for the silver lining, Lisa Wach.
Yes.
One more quick question before we move on to diabetes. If a person has Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, is there a need for consent from a family member before the vaccine is given?
If the person doesn't have informed consent, so if they themselves are demented to a level that they are not able to consent. Obviously, if you have a mild dementia, you can consent to a vaccine. If you have a more moderate, severe, so that they don't understand the implications of the vaccination, the potentials, if you don't get it and such, yes, that would need to be a family member, whoever is the assigned healthcare surrogate for that individual. Hopefully, people have an approved healthcare surrogate. Otherwise, it would be the next of kin. But yes, someone else would need to consent. Because these vaccines are both emergency use authorization, the EUA for abbreviation, you need to sign a consent form for them. And so someone would need to consent on their behalf.
All right, on to diabetes. Why is there an increased peripheral risk for this disease during the pandemic?
So some of the same things or some of the same kind of thought process. If we think again with diabetes, what are the things we know that help you keep your diabetes well controlled? Being active, you know, whether that's formal exercising and going to the gym or going out and doing things, people have cut back on their activities. Even just day-to-day activity. Most people were working outside of their home before, let's say. That amount of activity of whether you're taking the public transportation into work or walking in or riding or whatever, that was a lot more activity. A lot of people now are working from home, so that got cut out as well. We know that your diet and how you eat is really important for diabetes. There's a saying people are talking about, you know, how much weight they've gained during COVID. Is it the COVID-10 or COVID-15?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of that was the initial stress of what's going on. Some people are stress eating, and some of it is just you're home more, right? So you have more activity. So we know, again, that kind of goes against having your diabetes well managed. Medications, you need to be regular with your medications. If you lost your job or lost your health insurance, that might have impacted your ability to access your medications. So that might have an impact on some people. And then we know also that stress just the stress response that we have, the cortisones that are released, that also works against us maintaining good blood glucose, blood control. So we've had basically all these things combined during the past few months. So it's a little bit more challenging for those who have diabetes. You have to be more intentional to keep your diabetes well controlled.
And are we distinguishing between type 2 and type 1 diabetes in this conversation when we're talking about COVID?
So I'm talking about type 2. Thank you for that that clarification. Type 1, clearly for type 1, it's a matter of having your insulin and being regular with that. So if you lost your health insurance or your coverage and such, and that impacted your ability to get your insulin, then that certainly could have an impact as a type 1. If you're type 1 and you're still in the process of being well controlled and you need to have more frequent office visits with your physician, if there is difficulty of getting into the office or having televisits, if you didn't have that capacity, those types of things could also negatively have an impact for type 1. Obviously, still diet and exercise is important for both types of diabetes, but my initial comments were directed more towards type 2.
But with either type, I mean, if there's an issue with access to medication, I'm imagining that there might be an increased risk for death.
Yes, absolutely. So particularly in type 1, they require insulin, right? That's why they're taking insulin. And so that's what's keeping you healthy and keeping you not having major complications. Type 2, some type 2s are diet controlled and don't take medication. But for those who do take medication, yes, you need those medications as well so that you are not only having immediate death, but also preventing some of the long-term sequelae of diabetes, and organ damage, so damage to your kidneys resulting in dialysis, damage to your vision, your eyes resulting in retinopathy. You know, all those things are prevented or put at bay by having well-controlled glucose levels.
And very quickly, we've got about 10 seconds. Does a diagnosis of prediabetes increase the risk that a person might be hit harder by COVID?
Well, pre-diabetes, if they aren't doing what you need to do to prevent diabetes, so again, diet, exercise, if you're not able to do that as well, then you're more likely to spill over into diabetes. Pre-diabetes in and of itself should not.
All right. Lisa Walk, thank you so much. Such important information. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Lisa Walk is chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Natalie Stutzman is up next. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. You were just listening to one of the more acclaimed vocalists on the international stage, Natalie Stutzman. She was recently named principal guest conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra for the 2021-22 season. Even as women have made strides in nearly every career path imaginable, there are still only a handful of female orchestra conductors on the international stage. Conducting has been a dream of Stutzman since she was a teenager, but discouraged at the time by a largely negative attitude toward women in a male-dominated profession, she instead went on to an acclaimed career as a vocalist. Over the decades, the world of classical music has become more open to the concept of women as conductors, and Stutzman was able to rekindle her original passion, winning the admiration of luminaries like British conductor Simon Rattle, who urged Stutzman to pursue her dream, writing that she was the real thing. It's with pleasure we welcome Natalie Stutzman to the Regional Roundup for the remainder of the hour. So good to have you with us, Natalie.
Hello. Hi.
Hello. So your debut as a guest conductor for the Philadelphia Orchestra was in 2016, leading Handel's Messiah. Tell us about your relationship with the orchestra and how this relationship has developed over the past 4 years.
Well, thank you. I mean, your sum up of a large part of my life was just amazing. you are so clear, and it's so true. You know, the story I have with the orchestra is beautiful, and the connections are beautiful. The first time I heard the orchestra actually was under the principal guest conductor at that time, many years ago, was Maestro Muti, who then became a music director, as we know. And, you know, I grew up with the sound of this orchestra as a child. I had the Ormandy recordings. And the first time I sang with the Philadelphia Orchestra in 1997 was actually under Simon Rattle Baton, who became my mentor as a conductor. And actually, the day Simon decided to take care of me, he sent me a fantastic email, and that was the day I was singing with Yannick. So it's the connection is just amazing. And when I did my debut with the Messiah, and then I came back many times with a large repertoire, I mean, from the first hour, I must say, the chemistry with the orchestra was just amazing. I mean, the music making, their open mind, the reactions, it was just like a dream.
And Yannick, of course, is the conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, Yannick Nagesagat. Let's roll the clock back a little bit to when you were a teenager. You attended a conducting class, quickly realized it would be difficult to get onto the podium as a woman. What were the attitudes toward women and conducting at that time?
It was just horrible. I mean, it was just actually the teacher was, I mean, he couldn't say no that I entered the class, but he actually never gave me a chance to jump on the podium. So I was just following the course, and all my colleagues, who were all men, were just jumping on the podium, conducting the orchestra, which is what you need as a conductor. I mean, it's the only way to grow up, just to follow rehearsal is not enough, because the instrument is the orchestra. And I never got the baton to just make it. And it was so frustrating and so sad. And, you know, I quickly understand it was just impossible at that moment to dream and achieve anything as a conductor.
So why are doors beginning to open for women now?
Well, I think, I mean, actually, the life of classical music is following the society. And when the society is opening up, when the society speaks about all crucial movements, I think even the Me Too movement helped a lot to just open eyes to few people about injustice of lack of equality, also in the attitude of people. And as we see also, Black Lives Matter is important, because now we are talking about having more black people involved in the classical music. So we react, and we are testimony of the society. When you see countries like Scandinavia, I'm talking to you, I'm now actually in Norway, where I am chief conductor. Here in Norway, to be a chief conductor as a woman was no problem for many, many years already. Mm-hmm. Because if you see the politic, if you see the government in Scandinavia, it's almost there are more women than men, you know. So I think we just follow the society movements.
Yeah. So are some countries still less than welcoming to women at the podium?
Oh, yes. I mean, my origin country, you know, I born in Paris. France is very, very, very late with that. I mean, it's terrible. It's like 20 years reactions, not only with the vaccine at the moment, but also with the modernity. Spain is very late. Switzerland is very late. I mean, there are many countries still where it's very hard.
Well, you've also been, of course, celebrated for your work as a contralto. Tell us about what your work as a vocalist has meant to you and still means to you, because you do have an album coming out on January 15th.
Yeah, you know, I grew up as a musician. I was a pianist, I was a bassoon player, I was a cello player, and I started to take singing lessons when I was 17, actually after the conducting lessons. My parents were both opera singers, and I was lucky enough that I got this very rare contralto voice, which is the lowest voice for women, which is a very rare voice. And of course, it was attracting attention also because of the rarity of this voice. And I was considering always, my voice was my main instrument, you know. But I never felt I am a singer who is just fascinated by voice and make music. I grew up as a musician. I am a musician, and my main instrument was the voice. And I am still singing. Of course, I don't have a lot of time now because my conducting career has risen up so beautifully that I will dedicate fully to it. But I still keep few dates and few touring just for the pleasure, because my voice is still very fresh and I just enjoy so much now after so much work I did for building the instrument to just, you know, instead of just sharing and trying to explain things, just to do it myself is very relaxing somehow to sing at the moment. But I think it can, it's a very unusual background for a conductor. And it's actually bringing something different also to my work with orchestra. And in Philly, I mean, they really love when I'm singing a phrase instead of just talking and trying to explain with words what I have in mind. And I actually do sing a lot during rehearsal as well. So it's very practical to have an instrument in a good shape.
So you actually sing while you are rehearsing the orchestra? What does this do for you?
Sometimes when you want, you know, I have spent all my life to work how to shape a phrase, how to make the melody, how to find the color, how to use the vibrato here, how to change the legato. And sometimes it's so much easier when you want to build up a phrase with the orchestra, just to sing it instead of just starting to analyze intellectually what you are doing. So in that way, I use it. I am not singing all the time, but when it's necessary, I save a lot of time.
When a person sings, the physical being is producing the music, and I'm guessing there is a real sense of control of the sound as a vocalist, but as a conductor, you are leading or bringing the music out of others. Natalie, as you transition from one career to the next, when you're on the podium, do you miss that physical sense of producing music and even control that you have as a vocalist?
Actually, I must say no, because first of all, it's hard to explain, but when you are really connected with an orchestra, like I am with the Philly one, you really have the impression you are producing the sound. And actually, if you hear the same work conducted by two different conductors with the same orchestra, already from the first upbeat, from the first start of the first measure, you will hear the difference of sound depending who is conducting. So it's quite fascinating because, of course, the musicians are producing the sound, but it's not true to say that the conductor doesn't produce the sound. Mm. You also produce the sound. And the magic of being connected with an orchestra when the alchemy is there is that once you conduct, you have the impression you have all those voices. Instead of having only one voice, you have all the voices coming out from your body. It's amazing.
So when you are producing this sound, how do you approach a sense of harmony with musicians whose styles, interpretations, or temperaments might be much different than yours?
Well, you know, harmonies, rhythmic, it's just, you know, everything is in my brain. So I'm very sensitive to that. And this is how to build up the work. And this is all my own preparation on the score. I spent many hours. I'm very maniac, I must say, you know, attentive to all details of the score. And this is the work I love to do. I mean, this is really the first time I really feel I can really spread and share all the music making I have been working on all my life.
And so how does the pandemic and the distancing that's required of the musicians on the stage affect your production of this sound?
It does affect it because making music is about checking all the walls. It's avoiding any distance. And now we are forced to have those distance for the security. And it is really difficult. It is really hard.
How so?
With the distance, the musicians themselves, they cannot hear themselves like they are used to do. And the best the orchestra is, the more they are listening to each other, which makes this fantastic complicity. Then, as a conductor, you are so far away from everyone. I mean, if you see, Venison Hall is so huge. And I remember when I gave the beat to the timpani, it was like, I don't know, 30 meters maybe. This is really strange. And, of course, it's hard to get everyone together because it's far. And because the sound resonance takes time. It's hard to communicate because we have the mask. And as a conductor, the face is your third hand. As a musician, it's also we are communicating with the face. And now we have only eyes. So it's really challenging, but we know, you know, we have to make art and music alive. So we all try to be as brave as we can, as flexible as we can, and just make it happen. And that's what Philadelphia Orchestra is doing. That's what we are doing everywhere we can be happy enough to perform. And we just can't wait that this is over.
Natalie Stutzman, describe what is going on inside your mind when you are at the podium as you are conducting the orchestra during a performance. If you can, paint the picture for us.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the very beginning of your question.
Oh, while you're actually conducting, what is going on inside your mind as you're bringing all this sound out of the orchestra?
Just the music. Just the music. I'm totally into the score. I'm diving into the score, and if I am diving in it, I guess I would spread it, and my body language, every inch of myself will talk about it. And this is the way I want to share it with the orchestra, and I want to share it with the audience.
The pandemic, it's been such a long haul, and music has provided relief from stress for so many of us. In which ways, in your opinion, can music help to bring us across the finish line to persevere, you know, because we've got months of this ahead of us?
Well, you know, I think there was a lot of discussions about how useful we can be. And I just was thinking and talking with many people. I mean, during the worst times and the worst days, we in every country we had. I was traveling a lot still, and you know, every country has its up and down. And when people were really down, I mean, how would have been life for people without the possibility to listen to some music, to listen to radio? Not only talking, but also music, every kind of music, not having books, not having movies. I mean, life would have been just like to die. I mean, so there is no doubt that all of that is absolutely essential for the health of the mind, for the health of the soul.
So we only have about, I'm sorry, we've got 10 seconds left, and I just want to, you know, talk about briefly, the next concert with the Philadelphia Orchestra is January 28th to February 4th, correct?
Yes.
Online.
Online, absolutely.
Natalie Stutzman, unfortunately, very much so, we are out of time. It was such a pleasure to meet you on air.
Yeah, thank you. It was wonderful for me, too.
Thank you so much for joining us once again. Best of luck with the new season. And again, your new album is out January 15th, Contralto. And as always, we invite our listeners to join us online on social media. You'll find us at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer, John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us. Be well.